I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Educating children from America's cities may be the toughest challenge urban leaders face. Today, we'll talk to three guests who are deep into meeting that challenge. Indianapolis Mayor Bart Peterson is the nation's only mayor who has the power to charter schools. His point person in setting up and running the chartering operation is David Harris, who's with us today. He and Mayor Peterson have been recognized for their efforts with an Innovations in American Government Award. Erasmus Salcedo is founder of the Cesar Chavez Charter Schools in Washington, D.C. The schools use each subject, even music, to teach public policy. We'll find out from Ms. Salcedo and music teacher Emily Isaacson about life inside a charter school today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. David Harris is president and CEO of the Mind Trust and senior charter schools advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Bart Peterson. As the city's charter schools director, David created from scratch a full-scale chartering operation that won Harvard's Innovations in American Government Award in 2006 and has been widely cited for its high level of rigor and transparency. David, there are many charter school movements in America. Why did yours win the Innovations in American Government Award?
Well, we have something very unique in Indianapolis, and that is the mayor of our city is the entity that has the authority to grant the charters. In other words, in every place where you have charter schools, you obviously have to have an organization that is responsible for reviewing applications and selecting those organizations that should be granted charters, and then once those charters have been granted, the organization also has the responsibility to hold those schools accountable for their performance. And if those schools, for whatever reason, do not perform, then are obligated to revoke the charter. And across the country, there are all kinds of different types of organizations that have this authority. There are state boards, there are universities, there are nonprofits. But in Indianapolis, we did something unique nationally, and that is that the mayor had the authority. And what we think is so special about that is that a mayor has unique accountability himself to the people being served by the schools. Too often around the country, we've had charters granted by organizations that are not directly accountable to the people served by the schools. And as a result, there are far too many charter schools that got charters that never should have been granted them. And there's been a pretty significant quality variation around the country. And what has happened in Indianapolis is because the mayor is the authorizing entity, we've been very, very rigorous in our review of the applications. We've done it in a very transparent way. Each organization before they get a charter has to go through three televised public hearings.
Wow.
And we hire experts both locally and nationally to review and scrutinize these proposals. And the result is that we've granted charters to some excellent schools, and we have a very vibrant sector of charter schools in Indianapolis. The other thing that's been really powerful here is that we've had some very, very strong organizations and people get involved in charter schools, decide that this is an avenue for them to make a contribution to public education. And I think a major reason that some of our strongest not-for-profits and business leaders and civic and community leaders have decided to get involved is precisely because the mayor is the authorizer and that they see the quality and the rigor that he puts applications through before granting the charter, and then that he's very serious about holding schools to their performance standards.
How many charters do you now have?
We have 16 operating, with two more scheduled to open over the next couple of years and a handful in the hopper.
Mm-hmm. And how many students do they serve? Do you know?
The 16 schools now serve about 4,000 students, and at their full capacity will serve about 8,000 students. Typically, charter schools start with just a few grades, and then each subsequent year they add a grade.
And how many students do you have in the Indianapolis school system?
Well, we have 11 districts in Indianapolis. In the Indianapolis Public Schools, there are about 38,000 students. In the 11 districts in Indianapolis, there are about 132,000 school children.
And tell me what relationship the mayor has to the schools beyond charters, if any.
Well, that's an interesting question because in a lot of places there has been conflict between the traditional districts and the charter schools. And I certainly wouldn't say that there hasn't been any tensions. There have been here. But one of the things that Mayor Peterson and our team has worked very hard to do is to maintain a strong relationship with our districts, even as we have moved forward with the charter initiative. When the mayor became mayor, one of the things he started doing was meeting quarterly with all 11 school superintendents and continued to do that even as he launched his charter initiative. And while we went through a couple of periods of a little bumpiness, we managed to maintain that dialogue, which was very important. And we've really now seen something happen in Indianapolis that's unprecedented nationally, and that is that we have school superintendents now who are organizing charter schools and coming to the mayor for a charter. We've had two superintendents do that. We think those are the first and second times in the nation. Maybe somebody out there can correct us, but we think those are the first and second time in the nation that a school superintendent has organized a school and then gone to a third-party authorizer, because, of course, districts have the authority to grant charters themselves. And the reason that they came to the mayor is because of the rigor of the application process, but also because of the very, very effective accountability system that we've developed. We've had a third superintendent who has partnered with one of our existing charter schools, put that charter school in his school building, and is using that as a model for two academies that he's creating. So there are three separate schools in this one building, one a charter that's serving as a model for two separate academies created by the districts. So we've really managed to form very strong relationships, not just on a variety of unrelated issues, but actually on charter schools with our school superintendents. And we've got a couple of more superintendent-led charter schools that are in the works right now. So it's really one of the most interesting things that's happened in Indianapolis is how the charter initiative here has really sparked meaningful reform in school districts.
That's fascinating. Is that an admission, do you think, on the part of those superintendents that they do not have the kinds of accountability systems that they need? Is it a way to get around certain union restrictions? What I'm trying to really understand the motivation there and what it says about their own school district.
Right. I don't think it's an admission so much as they see that charters present an opportunity for them to do some things differently than they could otherwise do within their district and to give them some freedoms. One of the great advantages that charter schools have is that they're freed from a whole host of laws and regulations. And I think the superintendents saw this as an opportunity for doing something different, freed them from some of the regulations that they otherwise have to address. And so I think that they saw it more as an opportunity than anything else.
When you say free them from some of the regulations, like what?
Well, charter schools have opportunities in terms of staffing, their ability to hire people that don't necessarily have the same credentialing requirements that other schools have. And we have one superintendent, for example, who was very excited about some of the staff he was able to bring on to his charter school that he might not have been able to bring into his district. There are some freedoms in terms of schedule for the day. Almost all of our charter schools, in fact, all of our charter schools have extended hours. And that's a very, very valuable tool because so often the charter schools, certainly in Indianapolis, but also around the country, get students who are several grade levels behind. And if you're going to catch those students up, in addition to having terrific teachers and innovative approaches, you need to have just more seat time. You need to have these students spending more time on task. And that's something that charter schools have that is a huge, huge advantage. Charter schools have some freedoms in terms of bringing different kinds of school leadership on board. We've had some interesting dynamics where we have a CEO who's in charge of managing the business operations of the charter school and an instructional leader who manages the instructional leadership for a school building. So those are just a couple of examples of the types of freedoms that charters have.
What is it that keeps the superintendents from having those same freedoms within their own systems? State law, local school board, what's keeping them from doing these same things?
Well, we hear all the time from superintendents that they wish that they had more freedoms. I think it's a combination of state laws. To some extent, it's school board policy, and it's also some of the restrictions found in the collective bargaining agreements that they operate under.
And so let me go back and understand, David. You have, what, an elected school board for these 11 districts?
We have 11 separately elected school boards.
11 separately elected school boards. Now, how long have you had that?
Well, in 1970, former mayor, now Senator Lugar, led the effort to consolidate the city and county, the city of Indianapolis and the county, Marion County. And when he did that, the geographic boundaries for Indianapolis took on the same as the county. But a couple of things were left out of the consolidation, and one of those were the schools. So the Indianapolis Public Schools has essentially the same boundaries as the old city limits for Indianapolis. And then the 10 remaining what we call township schools are schools that were outside of Indianapolis but brought into the geographic boundaries of Indianapolis when the consolidation occurred.
And yet any of those, the mayor can charter a school in any of those districts?
Yes.
You're listening to Smart City. David Harris is our guest. He's president and CEO of the Mind Trust and senior charter schools advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Bart Peterson. Your first charter schools in Indianapolis opened when?
They were first approved December of 2001 and opened in September of 2002.
You've got now 5 years of experience. What have been the results?
Well, the results have really been impressive. Now, that's not to say we haven't had our bumps. We certainly have. But overall, we've seen dramatic increases in test scores. We have two types of tests that we ask our schools or we require of our schools. One is the state-mandated test that every public school in Indiana takes. And in that test, we've seen some really dramatic increases over the course of several years in performance measured against both our local districts and our statewide averages. We've seen increases in the double digits over a period of 2 years as compared to what is typically maybe an increase or a decrease of about 1% as an average for both our local and state districts. We also require our schools to take a test in the fall and the spring so we can measure the progress of individual students. And we've seen and by doing that, we're not only able to compare to Indiana norming groups but national norming groups. And we've seen our schools vastly outperform those norming groups from across the board. We have had a school that closed. We did have to close a school for underperforming. We had a school that was started by a local social services agency that is a very, very strong and successful social services agency that was focused on getting people who had actually already dropped out of high school and getting them to come back and get their high school diploma. And a lot of those students were well past the traditional school age. It's a terrific idea and one that we were very enthusiastic about. But they just had some serious management issues that resulted in the students not getting the kind of instruction that we thought was important, and that the financial management of the school had some serious problems. So we did have to close that school.
Did they know they had failed before you told them?
Yes. And not only did they know, although I'm not sure that they would have acknowledged at the time, but the broader public knew because every year, the mayor publishes a very detailed accountability report in which we state how the schools are doing, and we give the good, the bad, and the ugly. And the year before, we had been very clear that we had one school that was struggling and that they needed to make changes or they weren't going to continue to stay open. And so when the time finally came for us to take the dramatic step of having to revoke the charter, people who had been paying attention, particularly people in the media, we're not surprised this didn't come out of left field. And I think that really was important, that we'd been very candid that this was a school that was having problems and that needed to improve. And in a lot of ways, it didn't feel like it so much at the time, but in a lot of ways it was really an example of the success of the charter initiative here, that if you don't perform, you don't stay open. Mm-hmm. It's the perfect example of very, very serious accountability, and that the mayor was only going to be able – where it was only going to support those programs and those schools that delivered for families in Indianapolis.
What, in your opinion, has been the key to the improved performance?
Well, I think the key has been a couple of things. First of all, I think we've made good decisions up front about who gets the charters. I've only granted charters to organizations that both have a strong vision for how they can improve public education, but equally, if not more importantly, have the capacity to actually implement and execute on that vision and have the ability to manage an organization as complex as a charter school is. So first and foremost, I think we've made good decisions up front. But the second piece is, I think, our very, very strong and rigorous accountability methods that not only do we go in and evaluate the schools, but we publish the results of those schools in a very publicized way where the mayor gives a issues a report but also holds a press conference. And the schools know that if they don't perform, they're going to find that their failures on the front page of the newspaper. And in fact, the very first year we had a school that did struggle the first year, and they made it very clear to us that they were not going to have any sort of future reports that showed that their school wasn't doing very well, and they made some pretty dramatic changes and are now one of our highest performing schools. So that visibility that a mayor has and his ability to draw attention is a huge advantage in our ability to hold these schools accountable.
Is there any other mayor in the country that has charter authority?
We are – Mayor Peterson is still the only mayor in the country that has the authority. Mayor Slay in St. Louis has been very vigorous in his efforts to get it, and has actually – there's a proposal in the Missouri legislature right now that's being debated. And there have been several other mayors who've told us that they would like to have the authority if they found an opportunity that they would pursue that. But we are currently still the only mayor in the country with the authority.
What do you see as the future of charter schools in Indianapolis and in America?
Well, I think the future, there's a tremendous opportunity to continue to grow the sector and to grow charter schools, particularly, I think, in Indianapolis, where the schools have been viewed as being so successful and there's been such a tremendous amount of community support behind them, not just moral support, but actually people rolling up their sleeves and getting involved and serving on boards and not-for-profits going out and launching schools. So I think that the opportunity for growth is significant, but I do think there are some challenges. There are a lot of places where the schools haven't been as good as they should be, and it's incumbent upon authorizers to take action and close poorly performing schools. It's incumbent for authorizers to make sure that only those schools that have both the vision and the capacity to execute on those visions get charters. And there's a real talent deficit, and that's true, I think, throughout public education. But we need to do more to stimulate young, talented people to go into public education, and that's important both for our traditional districts but also for the growth of charter schools.
How do you do that?
Well, there are a couple of organizations out there that are doing some terrific work in that area. Teach for America, the New Teacher Project, New Leaders for New Schools are probably the three leading groups that are doing that, KIPP. And one of the strategies that we've taken in Indianapolis is to work aggressively to attract those organizations to expand to Indianapolis. And we have had some success. We're working to attract some of those that we haven't yet been able to attract. I think we need to find ways to support people who have entrepreneurial ideas in public education. The kinds of people who launched Teach for America and the New Teacher Project need to be supported more broadly. We need to come up with new and better ways to address the vexing problems of public education. And I think some of the folks that have had the most success are young education entrepreneurs who come up with a new idea for a better way of addressing the problem. And we need to, as a community here in Indianapolis, is something we're very focused on, supporting those education entrepreneurs. And that's one of the things that I'm spending a fair amount of my time is figuring out how we can support those people here. But I think all across the country, it's important that we invest in people, we invest in those organizations that are bringing new pipelines of talent into public education.
If the culture does not change in public schools, can you keep those people you're attracting?
That is a terrific question, because we do know from the research that a lot of times the most talented teachers, the teachers that have the highest GPAs and the highest test scores, are the most likely to leave and the least likely to return. So I think that's a major problem. We do need to change the culture. And I think one of the strategies of some of these more successful organizations is to concentrate a lot of these very talented people into one school building or one school district so they can support each other and address that. That's another reason why the Charter Initiative is so critical to the education reform movement, because it tends to be very attractive to those kinds of people because of the autonomies and the freedoms the charter schools have and the ability to innovate and the freedom from all of the regulations and the freedoms from some of the cultures in some of these other places that haven't been conducive to reform.
David, congratulations to you and Mayor Peterson on winning the Harvard Award in Innovations in American Government, and thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you very much.
David Harris is president and CEO of the Mind Trust and senior charter schools advisor to Indianapolis Mayor Bart Peterson. You're listening to Smart City. What's happening in city travel? Let's find out from Keith Bellows, editor of National Geographic Traveler. Keith, let's talk about cities. You've started a new column in National Geographic Traveler called City Life. Why?
Really, because in the last 5 years, the more we've looked at the sort of travel trends, the more we've seen that cities have become sort of city central. We started not too long ago a column actually called Hotel Central, which recognized the fact that hotels are becoming increasingly travel magnets. And, of course, so many of them are located in cities. But the really phenomenal thing about cities is if you look at the next, 20, 30 years, you're going to see an explosion in cities. There are going to be 19 cities over 20 million population in this century. In China alone, there'll be 13 new cities with a million population within the next 15 years. In our own backyard, you're just seeing sort of an explosion in, and this is partly driven by demographic shifts, of folks going back to the cities, living in cities, and visiting cities. And so you're also seeing, because so many people are going back into the cities, many cities, including the one that I live in, Washington, D.C., have become sort of reanimated.
London gets the cover of your April issue. What's fabulous about London?
Well, the wonderful thing about London, and I sort of grew up in London, is that it's a city that, despite some of the things that Prince Charles has said about its unholy architecture and so forth, its willingness to turn its back on its past, I disagree. I think it's done a very good job of combining true modernity with sort of classic British architecture. And so here you've got a city that, used to be, for instance, regarded as a terrible food city. Now it's got some of the best cuisine in the world. Used to have very sort of dowager kinds of hotels. Now it's, it's got very, very hip hotels. Used to not be a city that was particularly thought of as cutting edge, not at least since the 60s and the Carnaby era. And it really has become a true global city. Not that it wasn't, but it certainly wasn't necessarily thought of as a cutting edge city in the 90s, which it is now. And I think that actually our take on it was that we sent a writer back to sort of visit the London of his father. And the wonderful thing is all those classic London landmarks, Buckingham Palace and so forth, the war rooms, they're still there. But you've got the Tate Gallery and you've got a wonderfully sort of reanimated downtown area, the Millennium Wheel and so forth. And there are a lot of people who sort of complain about, sort of having lost the old London. But my feeling is, especially since they taxed people, so drivers no longer can just sort of willy-nilly go into the center of the city. You pay a big, hefty premium to drive your car into the city. Suddenly, it's a more walkable place, a more habitable place.
Your column on contemporary Houston surprised me. It made me think I've been missing a great urban destination.
I sort of agree with you. It kind of surprised me, too. I mean, here's our fourth largest city. And we do kind of think of Big Hair and, Dallas, the television program of a couple of decades ago. But this is a city that actually has become is becoming increasingly well-known for its art. It's got a great cultural sort of neighborhood around what's called the Museum District. And I don't think you would have even thought there would have been a Museum District in Houston. it's, you know, it's thought of, as we said in the article, redneck and conservative. But here you have, you know, the Museum of Fine Arts, which is a world-class museum. You've got the Benil collection, which, you know, the Benils were patrons to Andy Warhol. So you've got a lot of his early work there, Jasper Johns, Rauschenbergs. And around that, you know, has gathered a kind of emerging restaurant scene. So it's no longer just sort of ribs and the, you know, Tex-Mex. You've got places like the, you know, you've got classic places like the West Alabama Ice House, which is this sort of great classic, you know, sort of part bikers bar, part lawyers hangout. But you've also got, you know, new restaurants, like Mexican restaurants like Hugo's, which is not your sort of typical, you know, Tex-Mex stuff. Great hotels, Hotel Indigo, Hotel Zaza, great music. There's, you know, you can go to a place called the Red Cat Jazz Cafe, which has some sort of classic, you know, sort of old, you know, Billie Holiday kind of jazz. So it's not the place that it used to be.
You've mentioned several times hotels as part of the reason people travel today. What's happening in hotels, and how much a part of the travel decision do hotels really play?
I think increasingly more. I mean, it used to be that hotels were just a place that you parked your hat overnight. And now two things have happened. One, we saw the emergence of the boutique hotel, pretty much driven by Ian Schrager out of New York. And he basically said, you know, look, you don't have to have cookie-cutter hotels. You can have hotels that have some personality, that put some, you know, put a little twist on things. And so that's, you know, that's probably a 25-year-old phenomenon. But now what's happened is that everybody, it's become a mainstream thing. It's no longer just, you know, business travelers or upscale travelers that are demanding, you know, unique hotel accommodations. You want something that's a little bit more hand-tailored, a little bit more personal. And so I think that for a hotel now to really establish itself in a marketplace, it needs to sort of be a little bit more unique than just the sort of standard fare. The other thing that's happening is that a lot of the cities, especially in cities, have really encouraged, you know, investors into areas that perhaps were a little iffy. And a lot of folks are scooping up old buildings, old brownstones, you know, things, you know, places that have been a little bit downtrodden, and converting them into small hotels and with a lot of personality. Now, the trade-off is usually they're small rooms too. But, you know, they've got big plasma TVs. They've got Wi-Fi. They've got great phone systems. They've got, you know, they've got all those sort of the pleasures of home. But they've got some personality and a little bit of uniqueness.
If you were planning a weekend trip in the next 3 months, where would you go?
I would go to Montreal, but I say that all the time because it's where I'm from and I miss it so badly. But Montreal is actually one of those cities that represents a lot of what I was just saying. You've got a small footprint city, very walkable, very European, with an amazing sort of microcosm of Europe in the old city. And that's actually – there was a place that 15, 20 years ago, you know, you could pretty much see that area within about an hour. You certainly didn't stay down there, and you certainly didn't really hang around too much after dark. Now there's some classy hotels there, like the St. James Hotel, which is where the Rolling Stones stayed last time they were in town. It's in an old bank building. You know, this is a great example of a building that was shuttered when I used to live there, you know, 20, 25 years ago, which is now at the hub of a hugely energetic nightlife. And of course, you've got a, you know, Montreal always gives you the advantage of not only having great art, but great food and at a discount, you know, running 10 to 15% depending on what the Canadian dollar is doing against the American dollar.
Keith, we'll catch up with you next month.
Terrific.
Keith Bellows is editor of National Geographic Traveler. After a short break, we'll continue our conversation on what's happening in America's charter schools with the founder and principal of the Cesar Chavez Charter School in Washington, D.C., and one of its teachers who's figured out how to teach public policy through music. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from PlanEdison assistant editor Nate Berg.
If people really want to get where they're going faster, they'll probably pay for it. So says the federal government. With that in mind, the Federal Highway Administration is encouraging states to install toll collection systems on congested highways, which would charge drivers varying amounts based on the time of day and the volume of drivers on the road. Stamford, Connecticut's The Advocate reports that federal officials have urged lawmakers to find ways to update highways with these tolling systems, referred to as congestion pricing. The departments of transportation in many states, including Connecticut, are already studying congestion pricing as an option to reduce traffic jams and clogged roads. But the Federal Highway Administration doesn't just want states to study congestion pricing. They want them to actually put it in place, and are promising to award federal grant money to states that move forward with plans. And while traffic congestion is easily one of the most complained about problems across the country, some less self-centered issues also appear to be among the frustrations of the American public. A recent poll by Zogby America shows that a large and increasing number of Americans view the lack of affordable housing as a major issue. The poll found that 9 out of 10 people think that providing affordable housing in their communities is important, while less than half of those polled think that the nation's housing needs can be met with current housing policies. 3/4 said the presidential candidate's ideas about creating more affordable housing would be important in determining their vote. However, it is yet to be seen whether the presidential candidates will take notice of the public concern over housing issues. And finally, a bit of irony for Al Gore. The former vice president, presidential candidate, and the new celebrity of the environmental movement has been prevented from installing solar panels on the roof of his home due to zoning restrictions. According to the Associated Press, his exclusive neighborhood near Nashville, Tennessee, only allows solar panels and other energy-generating devices to be placed on the ground. But new rules will come into effect next week that will allow the former vice president to apply for the right to install the panels, so long as they stay out of the sight of neighbors and people on the street. Until then, Gore will have to remain stuck to the electric grid, another victim of outdated zoning. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for PlanEdison.com.
There's this word called gentrification. It leaves you full of humiliation, being a victim. House taken away, this happens almost every
day. Erasmus Salcedo is the founder of Cesar Chavez Schools in Washington, D.C. A former teacher and assistant principal in the city's public school system, she believes that public policy can be taught through all subjects. And with her is the school's music teacher, Emily Isaacson. You were assistant principal in the D.C. public schools for 6 years. What motivated you to start a charter school?
It was just a great opportunity to create my own school where every single one of the students will go to college. And knowing that with the charter school, I would have decision-making at who I hire, what to focus on, and manage my own budget, I really felt I could create miracles. And it was obvious for me that I could start a school with a focus on public policy because we were in Washington, D.C. So there's no doubt, there was no doubt in my mind that this was a good move because of what a charter school would allow me to do that would not be possible within the traditional school system.
Were those the things that chafed at you as assistant principal and made you feel like you couldn't do the things you needed to do to have students perform?
I would see my principal struggle with those issues. You know, she didn't have the freedom to select her teachers. Many times she was stuck with people that she just had to have because the system sent those teachers to her. She couldn't decide on what books or what curriculum that was already set. Obviously, no control over the budget. And in terms of being creative with the schedule or some of the, you know, curriculum, it was just not possible. So to me, when I learned of charter schools and realized that really sky is the limit in the things that you can do, there was just, to me, no question that this was the direction I personally wanted to go. Because as you can imagine, not everyone necessarily could endeavor into doing something from scratch. You really have to have I guess you could say, the stomach to for it, because it is a big, humongous challenge. I knew as an immigrant and as a minority in this country that, you know, your education in K-12, especially in high school, can make a difference in the opportunities you have in life. So it was a mission for me to make sure that if I had control of what was going to happen to those students that came to my school, that I just couldn't imagine a better way to affect that outcome than to do it myself.
Tell me about Cesar Chavez.
It was founded in 1998. Obviously, I am the founder of the school. And when I was thinking of what kind of school I would open, in my mind, I wanted to open a school, again, as I said before, that every student will go to college. But also being in the district, I wanted to focus on public policy. And to me, the name Cesar Chavez made a lot of sense, because I wanted to send a message to my students that regardless of who they were, no matter how humble their backgrounds were, that they too could make great things happen, especially for those that are most in need, just like Cesar Chavez did in his life, and that he was an inspiration to me. And again, I wanted my school to symbolize that idea, the importance of making changes to improve the quality of life of other people, and that to me that was what I wanted to do with my school, and that getting a college education and experience in public policy was going to allow me to do that.
Do you have to take any student who shows up at your door, or do you have some?
Absolutely.
So you have no admission standards?
No. I think that's the beauty of charter schools, the fact that they can provide options within public education to any student without, obviously, discriminating because of their grades or any other, you know, factor. And it's free. So it is a public school, and it is an opportunity for many of the students that could never probably afford private school to be able to have an equal option to attend a high-quality school.
You develop curriculum around a public policy focus, which seems, as you said, a particularly good fit for D.C. Tell me about the kinds of things you do.
Sure. We really model, in some ways, what a public policy program at the college level, meaning our students are required to take a public policy course either in the 9th or 10th grade, a semester course, just to introduce them to what public policy is and get a good feel that it means individuals making changes in the community and really understanding what the process is. And they do a three-week fellowship at a public policy institution to get exposure to what is public policy? What do people in public policy do? How do, you know, we affect policy? So it's first-hand experience. And then in their senior year, they write a 15 to 20-page public policy thesis where they study a problem that they feel very passionate about and research what policies exist and what are the pluses and minuses, and based on that knowledge, propose their own solution or revise policy to what already exists. And they have to present that to a panel of public policy experts. And then that's a requirement to graduate. So as you can imagine, doing this at the high school level, especially with young people that traditionally, because of their background, don't feel that they're engaged in policy that affects their lives, you know, to have the opportunity to be exposed and get that those experiences to prepare them so as they move on either to college or an adult life, no matter what they do with their lives, that they know the process, that they've been engaged personally in experiences, either by, again, doing the fellowship or writing their thesis, presenting it, even at, you know, a project where they go and testify in front of city council. I mean, you can think of just so many experiences that they're allowed to do, because that's our focus, and we require, you know, that is part of our curriculum and as part of them graduating from our school.
How do you use music, Emily, to illuminate public policy?
We do it on a bunch of different levels, sort of simple levels in terms of talking about objective versus subjective facts. And we usually work with that with just listening to music. What kind of commentary can you make that's objective that proves you understand what's going on versus something that shows your opinion about something? A lot of presentation skills in terms of how do you be a good speaker, body, presentation, all of those things. And then we've done various projects in the past from things talking about the role of music education in the larger education scheme, whether or not we think the media is useful in getting across messages. And then the two main projects that we've done in the past, and we're doing a third one this coming year, we did a sound collage project on gentrification, a musical memoir project where the students basically are presenting their own perspectives and life issues in song format. And then this year we're going to be doing a sound collage project on affirmative action.
Tell me about the gentrification project.
Well, one of the things that I love about music and the reason I chose it as a profession is it's in this day and age, it's in everyone's lives, and especially these students. They go home and listen to hours of music on end. So it's a really approachable and familiar medium. But I wanted to sort of take this thing that's so common in their lives and help them see it as a way to vocalize their perspective and other people's perspectives and make it a charged medium. So we started just by basic research, trying to understand, this is at an eighth grade level, what gentrification is, why people are for it, why people are against it, how it affects communities. And then we created interview questions and went into a specific neighborhood in D.C. that is going through rapid, rapid change, Columbia Heights, and just interviewed people on the streets, construction workers, government officials, teachers in the schools around that area, store owners, sort of everyone across the board that we could find, came back and talked about our experiences, and then the students used that information in two different ways. One was they took the sound clips and put them into a collage to try and give varying perspectives in a sound format. And then the second was using the information and the stories that they heard, they wrote their own rap or sort of R&B lyrics about it, and so presented the information in a song.
Do you develop your own curriculum? I presume you do.
Yes, I do.
And do you consider students, Emily, your co-creators?
Absolutely. I think one of the very exciting, challenging, but very exciting things about music at Chavez is most students have never taken music before. And at the moment, there's only a semester of music allowed or at Chavez. It's your only opportunity in eighth grade. And so people are coming into this class from a really different place. So every semester, we kind of re-examine what are we looking to get out of this and where are we coming from. So this is my fourth time teaching it, but we're totally redoing parts of it this year because that's what the students want.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guests are Erasmus Salcido, founder of Cesar Chavez Schools in Washington, D.C., and the music teacher there, Emily Isaacson. When students consider themselves co-creators, how does that affect how they feel about school and themselves?
I think it's vital, especially at the middle school age where you're being taught by your parents and by your teachers and grandparents, everyone around you, what to do and what not to do. I think there's a real sense of a loss of agency and that you either have to abide by the rules and get through or be a rebel. And one of the things I love about both of the projects, but especially the memoir project, is I think it really says to the students, we value your stories and your thoughts. And I find that the students throw themselves into that project. Kids come after school, during lunch, they're just continually working on it because I think it's one of the few opportunities adults are saying, we care about what you think and what you feel.
Why are you and your colleagues motivated to spend more time developing this kind of curriculum? Why do you want to be at a school like Cesar Chavez?
Oh, I think this is why we all got into education. Chavez does a really incredible job of hiring people who are motivated not just to teach students, but to really be community activists and to care about issues. And this is the stuff we love. We absolutely love the Shakespeare and the Beethoven and the more traditional things. But I think all of my colleagues feel very strongly about making a difference in our communities and in the world. And it's very exciting for us to be able to align our professional goals with our personal goals or our life views, our values. with our students and to empower them. There's certainly a sense constantly in education that time moves on, and you're catching these students for a moment, but you hope that the things that you teach them will pass with them. And it's exciting not just to teach them math skills and literacy skills, but also to teach them that they can make change and how to do that. So I think even though it takes a great deal more time, it's worth it. And it's also much more, it tends to be more creative than some of the traditional classroom things.
What are the kinds of issues that you've seen motivate your students the most? What are the public policy issues that middle school kids and high school age, you're never sure what to call them? What are the kinds of issues that motivate them?
They see a lot of issues in their everyday lives, and right. That these capstone projects are one of the moments where they're able to articulate those issues in a more concrete manner. So things like gentrification, which many of their neighborhoods are going through, gangfare, domestic violence, alcoholism, juvenile delinquents, environmental issues, certainly. What am I forgetting, Ms. Salcido?
HIV.
Yeah.
It's a big teenage pregnancy. It's a big... and some students at the high school level, sometimes surprise me and do care about pollution and care about Africa and just outside of their own communities. It allows students to really, address issues that they really care about. And they're like us. They care about what's going on in the world. And not a lot of them focus first in their community, but there are instances where they look beyond that. And it's very exciting because they give their heart and soul to that issue. And for a high school student, as you can imagine, it's a little bit of a pressure because they have 1 year of the thesis course and producing a 15 to 20 page paper and an issue that they care about. And then they get into the research and they find out, that the information they need is not there. Or just the experience itself, being a college prep, school prepares them for college, but anyway, the variety of issues is what, Emily mentioned, and you can think of many, many more.
You are opening your third campus. One of the real challenges is to scale up successful programs like yours. They often seem to hinge on the capabilities of their founders. What is the biggest challenge in maintaining quality and results as you open new campuses and admit additional students?
To me, because I believe of promoting within, I think that solves the problem of quality and results, because the two principals and the third principal are individuals that have been with Chavez for 5-6 years. And to me, I believe that using that approach is what's going to help me ensure that every Chavez that I open would feel like and look like the original Chavez.
Well, I thank you both for your work and for being with us on Smart City.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Erasmus Salcido is founder of Cesar Chavez Schools in Washington, D.C. Emily Isaacson teaches music there.
We miss you, son, even though you're in a better place. We still wear your t-shirt so we won't forget your faith. The pain still hits when we are reminded that you're gone. We all celebrate your birthday the way you would have done. Man, time moves fast, seems like we did ever yesterday. But really, it's been 2 years since you went away. Even though getting revenge won't bring you back, a loved one taken away feels like a heart attack.
I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. Like the rest of us, City View's commentator Walker Smith spends a lot of time waiting in line. He's noticed that different lines have their own special identities.
I enjoy waiting in line. I'm always hustling from one thing to the next, with few chances to reflect or rest, so getting queued up in a line can be a nice break. I can put my mind in neutral or do a little thinking ahead about how to get a jump on what's to come. Of course, not everybody feels this way about waiting in line. I know lots of people who won't wait 5 minutes for a table at a restaurant. But I don't mind waiting even as long as an hour. I just step out of the way, find a place to hang out, and watch the crowd while I wait to eat. When I was in college, the long, circuitous line to register for the semester ahead was the best place to find out what courses to take and which lecturers to avoid. College students are the artist of waiting in line. After all, Lines at the cafeteria, or at concerts and sporting events, or even to get one's diploma, are a fact of college life. So why not make the best of it? At Duke University, the line for the small number of free student seats available at each home basketball game is known as Krzyzewskiville, named for the head coach. 100 tents get pitched in front of the stadium 3 to 4 weeks in advance. Each tent consists of a group of no more than 12 students, one of whom must be at the tent at all times until 2 days before a game when everybody has to be there round the clock. Random checks by line monitors enforce the rules. Krzyzewskiville becomes its own community. The school has installed internet hookups in the lamppost so that students can stay connected to their schoolwork while waiting in line. Bad weather can make the wait miserable, but the good times that these fans have waiting in line more than makes up for any inconvenience. Not all lines are created equal, however. It takes more imagination and patience to make the best of a line of traffic at rush hour than it does to make the best of a long line at the grocery store on a heavy shopping day. But public radio is a good companion stuck in traffic, and the tabloids at the register are good entertainment in the grocery. Indeed, I find these tabloids to be terribly informative, not because of what they report, but because of what they reveal about how we think and what we want to hear and believe. For me, this is the best thing about waiting in line: the chance to learn what's on people's minds. For example, in the security lines at the airport, I've noticed that people have become a lot less patient over the last few months, which tells me that we've come to terms with the anxiety we feel about the new war on terrorism. And in the checkout lines during the holiday season last year, I noticed that people had become a lot more patient, which told me that we've come to a new appreciation of the importance of thoughtfulness and courtesy. We don't get too many chances to step back and take stock, which is why I enjoy waiting in line. In the ongoing monitoring of social values conducted by my firm, Yankelovich Partners, we have found that 91% of us agree that life is moving too fast and that we should all slow down a bit. What better chance do we have to do so than waiting in line? The haste we feel is why we bridle so much at being stuck in line. But the haste we feel is also why we should welcome the chance to wait in line. It's an opportunity to slow down a bit, to rest, to take a break from the fast pace, and to learn something about the people with whom we are waiting in line. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders whose next national meeting is May 1st and 2nd in San Jose to discuss turning urban amenities into urban assets. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.